Hello and welcome to Macrobytes, the economics and politics podcast from Aberdeen. My name is Paul Diggle, chief economist at Aberdeen.
And I'm Luke Bartholomew, senior economist at Aberdeen.
This week we are talking about China. On the day we're recording this, Premier Li Qiang has just delivered his work report to China's two sessions and announced a variety of economic targets and policies. Now, the Chinese economy has struggled somewhat over the past year and inflation has turned negative and there have been ongoing challenges in the property sector. But on the other hand, monetary and fiscal policy has been loosening, with government support measures most recently also trained on the equity market. And China did beat its 2023 growth target in the end, expanding just over 5% on the official numbers. And over the long term, there are, I think, plenty of both challenges and opportunities in China's future growth trajectory. So there's a lot to discuss. And we are joined by Robert Gilhooey, who is senior emerging market economist here at Aberdeen. Welcome, Bob.
Thanks, Paul.
So, Bob, hot off the press on the day we're recording this is that Chinese policymakers have announced the 2024 GDP growth target of around 5%. I think that was in line, maybe slightly above expectations. But what's your initial reaction to the target, Bob? Is it realistic given what you are seeing in the Chinese economy?
Yeah, I mean, first of all, I think I'd agree with Premier Li Qiang that this target will, quote unquote, not be easy. Now, this is not actually the first time he's used this phrasing. Last year, he also said the 5% target wouldn't be easy. But given an exceptionally depressed 2022 with the zero COVID lockdowns and then a very substantial kind of reopening bounce associated with the end of that, in fact, last year's target was exceptionally easy to achieve. And I think in that context, 5.2% growth last year was pretty tepid. I guess we have been somewhat on tenterhooks waiting for the rumoured ultra-long government bond issuance, and that was in fact confirmed at the NPC this morning. So that's a 1 trillion RMB package to fund strategic sectors and security capacity in key areas. I think this, you know, it should keep fiscal policy moderately supportive. We've also got the Chinese version of a cash for clunkers scheme for white goods and electric vehicles, you know, maybe giving that kind of household consumption a little bit more support. But it's also the case there's not really a kind of major step shift in policy being signalled. Little new information for support for the beleaguered property sector. And, you know, national security just continues to run through government policies and communications as a top priority. Military budgets set to expand by 7% for the second year running. Funding for science is going to rise by 10% with the specific aim of boosting self-reliance. So I think this all just kind of implies a more targeted policy approach, still incremental. You know, the policy bazooka that everyone in markets keeps hoping and wishing for, I think, has been firmly retired. And, you know, with this set of policies, I think it's still going to be quite hard to turn around economic and market sentiment.
So, as you say there, Bob, part of China's disappointment post-reopening has been the drag from the real estate sector, which, of course, is a considerable part of the Chinese economy and has faced a number of headwinds. Could you put some figures on the size of the real estate adjustment, how far through that process we might be?
Yeah, look, it's been quite amazing how far some of the kind of key real estate metrics, particularly those on the kind of pipeline of activity, have fallen since the three red lines kicked off real estate de-risking at the start of 2021. I mean, if I was to pick one key measure, so new starts, I mean, that's essentially kind of new building projects that are being have ground broken. Those are down a pretty staggering 70% since early 2021. So you feel free to insert your own mind blown emoji there. I mean, how you judge the adjustment overall, I think it just depends really what you think fundamental demand is, and this is quite a difficult one overall to have much confidence on. The good news, relatively speaking anyway, is that, you know, China's population might have started to fall in absolute terms in 2022, but I don't think that signals like an impending collapse in kind of fundamental housing demand. You know, urbanization is still incomplete. There should still be some scope to upgrade the housing stock, so knocking down some of those old buildings and rebuilding. And even if there are kind of concerns about excess vacancies, particularly in the lower tier cities, I don't think it's the case that China's housing stock is complete and doesn't need any more new building. And you can kind of get this by thinking about kind of demographic shifts. Now, I think here's the composition that matters as much, if not more, than the total moves. So if you think about household formation, kind of 5-year age buckets, well, actually, demographic change still gives you this sort of reasonable batting average effect, such as the changing population composition should be driving household formation, adding, you know, sort of roughly about 4 million households or so each year. Now, that's still a lot lower than what it used to be, but it's not nothing. So now, assuming vacancies can be kind of held roughly as is, I think that would imply the flow of housing is actually, the adjustment of the flow of housing is actually around about 90% done in terms of what we need to see to get that back to what we would consider kind of fundamental or underlying demand. Now, fortunately, you know, given lags between kind of construction and fixed asset investment within national accounts, we'd probably put that at around about only kind of 2/3 of the adjustment being done in terms of the drag on investment and GDP. So the remaining drag, I think, probably best guess, is probably still going to weigh in growth by around about 1.25% over the next year or two. And that kind of, I think, helps explain why we're, you know, we're a bit below consensus on our growth forecast, and, you know, we're a bit sceptical that the 5% growth target for this year is actually going to be hit.
So on top of those real estate challenges, there are concerns that China faces other structural headwinds to its long-term growth potential around demographics, albeit nuanced, I think, by some of those composition points that you were making there, Bob, and then crucially around productivity. Indeed, weak productivity growth has moved up the agenda of policymakers recently. So I wondered, why has productivity performance been slowing over time, and in particular, it's been poor post-pandemic? I mean, it does stand somewhat in contrast with the recent US performance. So what is going on there in China?
Yeah, China's certainly bucking that global trend or US trend. I mean, if we consider productivity over the last 25 years, so taking a slightly longer sweep first before we get into this post-pandemic stagnation, we can think of it as kind of three phases as kind of informing how we think about productivity. So in the first phase, you know, China's integration to the global economy shortly before and after its accession to the WTO, this involved massive sectoral reallocation of workers from low productivity, low wage jobs in agriculture to higher productivity jobs in manufacturing and services. This was helped by large scale infrastructure investment, which kind of had a positive externality effect of just making it easier to do business when you've got better roads, rail, communications and transportation links as well. And simultaneously, the, you know, private sector was allowed to take a much larger role in the economy. Foreign investment was bringing in better business practices. So this all was just kind of helping resources flow to more efficient uses. And that kept productivity growth in that kind of golden age of growth exceptionally, exceptionally high. In the second phase, you think of that as post-GFC to pandemic, productivity growth slowed very notably. In part, I think some of this reflects some of those kind of easy gains having been used up, but I think it also reflects a degree of capital misallocation beginning to build in the system. You know, there was this credit bazooka launched after the global financial crisis to counter the drag on the Chinese economy. Don't think all of that went to very productive uses. And then we actually also saw a kind of more statist approach emerge as President Xi took office. The leeway enjoyed by the private sector really began to kind of diminish over this period, and that's continued into the post-pandemic period too. Now, the third phase post-pandemic, you know, this is, I think, the most concerning one. Now, I should note, first of all, it's quite hard to disentangle this. We need to be mindful that productivity is inferred rather than directly measured, but our estimates of total factor productivity imply a near stalling since the end of 2020, and that is very alarming, to say the least. Now, as we were just kind of discussing, it does seem likely to me that kind of the transitioning from real estate sector to one that's kind of more state dominated probably will weigh on growth for some time to come, given these kind of substantial upstream and downstream linkages. You add on to that China's relatively late move to endemic living, which probably negatively impacted household and corporate expectations by the need to self-insure. You know, unlike the massive fiscal transfers that US households enjoyed, there was very little to no support given to Chinese households. And finally, you know, just national security, as I said at the start, just continues to move up the policy agenda. And I think this kind of secondary kind of the state trying to insure against geopolitical pressures probably also necessitates kind of moving down the kind of efficiency to resilience spectrum. So I think the kind of $1 trillion, trillion RMB question is really kind of whether Chinese productivity is actually going to kind of bounce back. I think, you know, are these headwinds to productivity going to fade as we kind of normalize, or is it going to be something much more protracted that's really going to weigh on Chinese growth and therefore the global economy for a much longer period to come?
And then it is worth saying, outside of those headwinds to productivity and the uncertainty around those questions that you laid out, there are, of course, still considerable tailwinds that have allowed Chinese growth to be, in an absolute sense, you know, very high on a global basis, on a historical basis. So what do you see as the key engines of Chinese growth over the medium term?
Yeah, like, I mean, it's certainly harder to appeal to what you kind of consider the more traditional engines of growth, those things that powered some of the Chinese productivity, you know, infrastructure investment that has been so rapid. I think the scope there for major projects to drive growth has surely fallen. I think, you know, Chinese policy is kind of pushing in infrastructure investment into kind of areas where you don't get that kind of positive externality effect. You know, you've built all the kind of roads and rail you largely need. You're kind of pushed into more unglamorous infrastructure projects. You know, if you have to redo Beijing sewers, that doesn't provide much of a kind of long-lasting boost to the economy's productive capacity in the same way that kind of building road or rail or airports might do. Similarly, you know, China's probably been hitting up into the limits of export-led development strategy, just given its sheer size in the global economy. As you said, look, you know, some of these engines of growth aren't kind of out of gas yet. Scope for sectoral reallocation does remain. China's share of workers in agriculture remains, I think, roughly where you'd expect it to be, actually, given China's stage of development. So similarly, well, you know, while we have concerns about property, urbanisation has also got a bit of room to run as, you know, workers can move out of agriculture and kind of more into city jobs. And even if the workforce is falling, you can still swap quantity for quality. Returns to education and skills should help kind of offset some of the near term drag on the labour force as that's declining. And China has shown some ability to tap into new growth engines too. China dominates green investment production in some products such as solar. Its electric vehicle production has absolutely surged over the last 3 years. China just overtook Japan as the world's largest exporter of autos. And then if you look at kind of some other kind of less tangible indicators, China does do quite well in several measures of innovation, particularly related to kind of STEM, which should be positive for productivity. So to name a few, you know, China's R&D spending is second only to US. China's triadic patent applications, so these are ones that need to be approved by the US, Europe and Japan. That's a pretty high bar. You know, those have risen quite notably over the last 10 years or so. They've overtaken that of manufacturing powerhouse Germany. China's academic research is actually now comprises more than a quarter of the world's top 1% most frequently cited scientific papers. So, you know, there are some positives there around kind of innovation and science that we shouldn't ignore. And, you know, as I said before, there's a lot to be concerned about. I think a more balanced assessment needs to consider why China's maybe been so resilient to date, and therefore kind of whether some of these aspects of kind of hidden strength and resilience could persist.
Well, let's turn, Bob, from the activity picture to inflation and prices then, because inflation has, of course, recently been negative in China now. Some of that reflects, I think, cyclical economic weakness, overcapacity in pork markets specifically. But people do worry as well about possible deeper Japanification of the Chinese economy. Do you think that kind of concern is justified, or maybe a related concern that China might be heading into the so-called middle income trap?
Yeah, I don't think it's a surprise that comparisons with Japan are pretty obvious, aside from kind of the obvious around falling population, real estate risks. Obviously, Japan had a lot of tensions with the US on trade policy as well. And then, you know, policy continues to kind of favour this kind of incremental supply-side biased approach, which could risk, you know, embedding deflation in a more kind of permanent manner. And I think, you know, it's hard to fully rule this out, particularly over the longer term, but there are reasons to think that this Japanification or the Japanification risks are kind of overstated, both in terms of kind of how the channels could operate and also kind of the immediacy. I don't really see it as a very near-term risk myself. Now, so thinking about the channels a bit more, you know, deflation becoming ingrained could be fairly damaging for the Chinese economy. You know, real interest rates would be pushed up, weighing on economic growth. This could potentially set the stage for a balance sheet recession, in which the kind of the state is struggling to offset a private sector retrenchment. And given some concerns about the fiscal position in China, authorities may be a bit loath to kind of loosen fiscal policy to the extent really needed to turn the economy around. But even if this kind of nominal backdrop feels somewhat risky, particularly over the medium to long term, you know, Japan was an advanced economy, not an emerging market when its bubble burst at the end of the 1980s. You know, China's low levels of GDP per capita, I think, still imply, you know, a large potential for catch-up growth, difficult to achieve, but that potential is still very much there. I think this should reduce the risk that real growth steps down to the same degree as was the case in Japan's slide into its lost decades. Your Chinese policymakers are also quite aware of the Japanese experience, which I think is worth noting. State-owned banks remain a very powerful lever to shore up lending within China. Bad loans can be carved out by the asset management companies, as have they done in the past. They did that in the late 90s. And then, you know, China's relatively closed capital account and trade surplus, I think, surplus also removes this kind of risk of kind of sudden stop capital flight dynamics that could really kind of squeeze the economy more forcefully. So, you know, put simply, if money is effectively kind of trapped within China, you know, you do have a bit more policy wiggle room to go there.
And then given this growth and inflation backdrop we've been talking about then, Bob, of course, stimulus has been gradually stepping up. And I think a big part of the Chinese macro story is the push and pull of the macro headwinds. On the other hand, increasingly accommodative monetary and fiscal policy. How stimulative is the stance of Chinese policy? And indeed, in an economy where there are so many levers, how do we even measure that? I mean, I know that this week we've seen more in the way of easing announcements. Are we likely to get to a point at which policy stimulus is more than offsetting the growth headwinds?
Yeah, look, it's always a really tough call to judge the policy stance in China, even in a backward-looking sense. As you said, you know, lots of policy levers are being pulled at any one point in time. Which ones are the kind of primary instruments being used tends to vary. And I think there's good reason to expect that the impact of different policy levers also changes over time, reflecting kind of structural change in the economy and also change in the way financial markets run. You know, financial markets have become much more deeper, more kind of efficient, advanced over time too. Now, our preferred approach is to kind of summarize using principal component analysis for our China Financial Conditions Index. This does have, I think, some advantages in that it puts a bit more emphasis on the kind of combined outputs or end results, rather than just kind of taking the policy variables at face value. Now, our Financial Conditions Index actually implies that this kind of plethora of small incremental policy easing measures has been adding up and has been gaining traction. And we estimate that the kind of financial conditions have been pushed into a kind of position of, it's not great, but it's kind of modest accommodation over the course of 2023 and into 2024. So that kind of policy backdrop, I do think, is kind of adding up and should be providing more support to the economy. Our modelling also suggests there could be around about an 8-month lag from a loosening to the kind of peak impact on activity. You know, we've had pretty decent government bond issuance over the last 5 months. This should help kind of, I guess, build on some of the recent economic momentum and probably negate some of the downside risks too.
So another thing that policymakers have recently become concerned about is the weakness of the Chinese stock market. So I wanted to ask a little bit about the role and the importance of the stock market to the Chinese economy. I mean, we often talk in the US and developed markets of the importance of equity markets as part of broader financial conditions. They have an impact on growth through wealth effect, as they're a large vehicle for savings for many households, have a role through sentiment that, you know, they're an easy barometer for some people to latch onto as a measure of how well the economy is performing. Whether that's true or not, I guess, is quite different to whether it has a sentiment effect, which it tends to. And then, of course, as an important source of capital for firms as well. But I'm not sure if any of those factors are quite as strong in China as a savings vehicle or as a vehicle to raise finance. So what is the relationship between the stock market and the economy in China, and why have policymakers become so concerned about it recently?
Yeah, I mean, look, you take the latter part quite quickly. They don't like seeing big falls. We had this kind of instance of some structured products, which were called snowball derivative contracts. They unwound as the stock market continued to fall. This generated a very sharp fall, particularly within the kind of SME small cap equity index. The authorities never like a sharply declining equity market, just for, you know, financial stability reasons or fear that it triggers even larger falls. So they did intervene, and those kind of markets are back up. They're still, you know, down very substantially off their peaks, but I think that kind of fear of financial stability risks or contagion has kind of largely passed. But going back to your like more fundamental question, you know, I'd say it was a fairly, if not very, weak relationship between the stock market and the economy in kind of both directions. I mean, first of all, you know, much more household wealth is tied up in property in China than compared to other major economies. So perhaps double the share compared to the US, reflecting this kind of tilt towards property. Exposure to equities is, you know, correspondingly quite limited. And then lastly, I think there's this political economy dynamic. The authorities don't want to risk financial stability condoning this crash, as we kind of mentioned before, but allowing a stock market boom doesn't really fit in with their de-risking agenda either. I think they got quite burnt during 2015-16, when there was a very rapid spike and then deflation of the stock market bubble. And in a sort of communist party in shock indifference to capitalism, I reckon they'd actually just rather have firms raising money through state-dominated banking system, which can help kind of align lending with strategic industries rather than necessarily using the equity market as a kind of primary channel for firms to raise money.
And then, of course, finally, there is a US presidential election looming later this year with potentially quite significant impacts on China. So two questions, Bob. So first, what is the current state of US-China relations? There seems to have been something of an improvement, a bit of a thawing recently, but that is still in the context perhaps of a wider structural deterioration. And then secondly, what would Trump 2.0, to coin a phrase, mean for the Chinese economy?
Yeah, I think it would be fair to say there has been some stabilisation US-China relationship. Both sides certainly have put in some effort to stop a kind of free fall over the last year. Taiwan elections, perhaps the kind of dog that didn't bark in this case. There was no reaction to the quote-unquote unofficial US delegation trip to Taipei. You know, you could compare that to a very substantial show of military force when Speaker Pelosi visited in 2022. And I think that could speak to a desire to hold on to kind of some of the progress made in repairing the dialogue between the US and China. But, you know, markets also have short memories. It was only 30 months ago when the US shot down a Chinese alleged spy balloon or meteorological balloon. And I think that's a good illustration of the dynamic which swings between relative optimism and kind of maybe extreme pessimism about the US-China relationship. I think one can still argue national security, concerns about trade, growing Chinese economic might all probably push for a kind of ongoing deterioration in the relationship. And then there's Trump, as you mentioned. It seems highly likely. I think the Biden small yard, high fence national security approach would be jettisoned under Trump 2.0. Across the board tariffs, you know, perhaps this morphing into a kind of large yard protectionist strategy. Trump can do an awful lot tariff-wise without congressional approval. So trade and US-China relations are an area where other political forces in the US just don't act as a check in the same way they might do on domestic policy setting. And, you know, a tough on China line is fairly bipartisan anyway. So even if they could push back, would they? It's a kind of open question. In terms of the impact on Chinese economy, you know, an interesting feature of Trump 1.0 tariffs was that it pushed down on the Chinese currency almost one for one with the rise in the weighted average tariff rate. So we could see some very substantial downward pressure on the renminbi, which could maybe mitigate some of the shock on the Chinese economy. That said, you know, FDI has already fallen very notably. And a kind of Trump shock, which could include actions beyond just tariffs this time round, could certainly amplify these reshoring pressures, perhaps creating a longer drag in the economy that the depreciation, frankly, won't do very much to offset at all. So this kind of severe decoupling scenario could potentially also push the Chinese authorities further down the efficiency resilience spectrum, and, you know, it's probably amplifying the negative impact over the medium to long term too. So, you know, I'm not very optimistic on what Trump, the second round, could mean for China.
All right, well, I think that will be the note on which we leave it for today. As ever, please do like, review, and subscribe wherever you prefer to get your podcast. And then all that remains is for me to thank Bob for joining us today and to thank you all for listening. So thanks very much, and speak again soon.
This podcast is provided for general information only and assumes a certain level of knowledge of financial markets. It is provided for information purposes only and should not be considered as an offer, investment, recommendation, or solicitation to deal in any of the investments or products mentioned herein, and does not constitute investment research. The views in this podcast are those of the contributors at the time of publication and do not necessarily reflect those of Aberdeen. The value of investments and the income from them can go down as well as up, and investors may get back less than the amount invested. Past performance is not a guide to future returns, return projections, or estimates, and provide no guarantee of future results.